Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Welcome as we continue the next part of the sutta discussion. In fact, we're still in the previous part since I wasn't able to complete that before we ended for summer recess. I want to make just a few little changes in the program of the sutta studies, in the syllabus, if you have the syllabus with you. On page 2, this is under category 5, the path to liberation, on page 2. There's item number 8 called Stages of Purification, Sutta 24, the Rata Vinita Sutta. I will take that off at this point. Maybe I'll put it in later. But to explain it, one really has to go through the cultivation of wisdom. It's sort of out of sequence here. And then on the next page, this is under category 6, the practice in detail, the Noble Eightfold Path, the discussion of the path factors. I won't do that in the sutta class because I'm doing that in the Saturday discourses. So I'd just be repeating what I'm already doing on Saturday. Okay, so now today we take sutta number 8. This is called the Salaika Sutta. The word Salaika, it's translated effacement, but the English word effacement is also a rather obscure word. We don't use it very often. Does anybody know what it means, the word effacement? Would anybody know what it means without looking it up? Yeah, I think I had to look it up also. It was Venerable Nyanamoli's choice. I left it because he had selected that rendering. But it means something like erasing, removing. I also looked up the Chinese translation of this in the sutta. Jian sun, which means gradual damaging, or it could be reduction. That's a good idea. Gradual reduction, gradual removal. Maybe erosion would be. Erosion. And from the sutta, it becomes clear that it's the theme of the discourse is ways of removing, erasing, eroding defilements from the mind. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove. And then one evening, a monk named the Venerable Mahachunda. Mahachunda was one of the great arahat disciples of the Buddha. He came to the Buddha, paid homage to him, and then he asked a question. And the first part of the sutta, I have to admit, it's rather difficult, and it's concerned with very high stages of attainment. I'm more interested in the later part of the sutta, but first we'll have to deal with this part. Okay, he says, this is his question, he says, various views arise in the world associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world. Now, these are the two great themes of speculative philosophy, whether it be Western philosophy or Eastern philosophy. particularly in Indian philosophy, these were the two topics that engaged the thought, the reflection, the concerns of the philosophers from the very earliest period of Indian philosophy. And so we have coming from the once Indian thought began to emerge from the rather primitive Vedic period, thinkers began to speculate, what is the ultimate nature of the world? What is the ultimate nature? Okay, looking outward, they saw the diversified world surrounding them, and they began to speculate, what is the nature, the ultimate nature of the world? And they came up with a variety of philosophical views. Some said the world is eternal and everlasting. Others said that the world has been created in time by an almighty God. Some said the world has emerged mysteriously out of a kind of primeval chaos. Some said the world goes through cycles of arising and passing away. Some said the world will exist forever into the future. Others said the world will at some point come to a complete end. Some said the world is infinite, boundless. Others said the world is finite, that if you travel far enough, eventually you come to the outer boundaries of the world. There were all such speculations were being circulated at the time of the Buddha. There were different schools of philosophy based on these different conceptions of the nature of the world. At the same time, thinkers were looking within themselves, and they were speculating about the nature of the self. What is the nature of the self? Is there a soul? And if there is a soul or a self, what is its nature? And especially the thought that engaged them, is this self eternal and everlasting? Or is the self perishable, finite, bound to come to an end? So this divided the thinkers of the period into the two great camps of the Buddha's age. The two great opposing camps were the eternalists. These included mostly the Brahmins, the thinkers who based their philosophies upon the Vedas and texts that evolved from the Vedas, like the Upanishads. They said the world, the self, is eternal, everlasting. Some said the world and the self are ultimately identical. When you penetrate to the ultimate nature of the world, you find it's the same as the ultimate nature of the self. When you penetrate deeply into the ultimate nature of the self, you find it's identical with the Brahman, the ultimate support, the ultimate reality behind the world. On the other hand, in the other camp, there were the materialists, the annihilationists, who said that human existence arises from combinations of the four great material elements. Mind is just a byproduct of matter. When the body breaks up at death, everything comes to an end. The person, the individual, is annihilated and does not exist after death, and there's no continuity beyond death. Nothing survives except the way we influence other people and other events. But there's no continuation of consciousness in any form. Okay, the Buddha in his discourses developed critiques of all of these views. He summed them collected them all together, especially in the first discourse of the Digha Nikaya. This is called the Brahmajala Sutta, the discourse on the all-embracing net. The Buddha has collected all the different views. When you take all of their subdivisions, they come out to 62 views, and these are all collected. And in the Majjhima Nikaya, there's a sutta number 102 called Panchatthaya Sutta, the five and three. Here the Buddha has also collected together many of these speculative views. And for the Buddha, all of these views are just obstacles on the way to liberation. They all arise out of misunderstandings or misinterpretations. And all of them have to ultimately be abandoned and relinquished, not by developing. That was another position at that time. It was taken another camp, was the camp of the skeptics. These were the ones who said it's impossible to know with certainty anything about the world, anything about the self. And so we're not going to make any commitment to any fixed position about the world and the self. But the Buddha was not in the skeptical camp or the agnostic camp, but the Buddha understood the nature of the world. He says, I am one who understands the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way to the cessation of the world. But for the Buddha, all of these speculative views about the nature of the world, the nature of the self, all of these arise out of basic conceptual errors. The error, mistaken notion of a world existing somewhere out there, somehow as a substantial entity. And the idea of a self as something in here, a substantial self which is facing the world. Okay, so all of these views ultimately have to overcome not by skepticism, but by insight, by true realization. Okay, so now Chunda asks the question. He says there are these various views, doctrines about the self, doctrines about the world. And now the next question, I have to admit, it's rather obscure in the Pali, obscure to myself. He says, now does the abandoning and relinquishing of those views come about in a bhikkhu, that's in a monk, who is attending only to the beginning, what's put here, of his meditative training? That's the sort of explanatory gloss based on the commentary. But if we just take the original Pali text, it just uses the word adim eva nuko bante bhikkhuno manasi karoto eva metasang dittinang pahanang hoti evang etasang dittinang patinisago hoti. So the key word here is adim, beginning. A monk who is attending only to the beginning. And the commentary introduces this explanation. One who is attending to the beginning, then it says, for one who is attending through the first attention, the first stage of meditation, or the early stages of insight, without having attained the path of stream entry. Now, in earlier talks, I explained about the four stages of realization, four stages of enlightenment. And the first of these four stages is called the stage of stream entry, sotapatti. And one who reaches this stage is called a stream enterer. Now, one of the accomplishments of the stream enterer is to cut off, to eradicate clinging to views in their entirety, or clinging to all wrong views or distorted views. The stream enterer is one who has seen the truth of the Dhamma, the truth of the Buddha's teaching. And so by seeing the truth, the stream enterer relinquishes or gives up even the tendency to hold to any distorted view, any erroneous view. And so it's only at the stage of stream entry that it can be said that a person has completely abandoned and relinquished all views about the self, all views about the world. Up to that stage, even though as Buddhists we don't hold any fixed views about the self, fixed views about the world, but still the tendency to these views are there. And maybe this is quite remarkable to me that I used to hear in Sri Lanka that there were people who were like practicing Vipassana meditation for years and years, even people who were prominent teachers of Vipassana meditation. Then sometimes a teacher would appear in India who was teaching doctrines strongly based upon the view of self, of Atman. And some of these people who were longtime practitioners of Vipassana meditation would come to regard these teachers, these gurus, as their teachers, their gurus, which means that even though they might have reached certain stages through the practice of Vipassana, but that tendency to a view of self is still there. And so if one meets a charismatic guru who teaches a doctrine of self, or somebody who is very convincing with his argumentation, there's still the disposition to believe in a self. Or if one is afflicted with a lot of problems, difficulties, and one's belief in principle of karma is not strong, then one will start praying to the Almighty God, please help me, please help me. And so there are these tendencies which are only overcome completely by reaching the stage of stream entry. And so now the Buddha answers the question of Mahachanda. He says, Chanda, as to these various views that arise in the world associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, again now, this explanation is somewhat obscure, even in the Pali. If the object in relation to which those views arise, which they underlie, and which they are exercised upon, is seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then the abandoning and relinquishing of those views comes about. I actually find it easier to understand it from the Pali than from the English translation. Let me explain it on that basis. Okay, I'll retranslate it very literally. Wherever these views arise, whatever these views underlie, whatever these views lie along with, And wherever these views, whatever these views are exercised upon, whatever they latch onto, grasp onto, that should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Okay, we have a sequence here from the weaker to the stronger. Okay, the point is that the views of self, the views of world, arise based upon certain objects. They grasp onto, latch onto certain objects. Views about the self will grasp onto the five aggregates: body, feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness. Views about the world will grasp on to what is out there, everything that stands opposed to or in relation to whatever I take to be internal, whatever I take to be myself. Okay, now, first the views arise on the basis of these objects. Then as the views gather strength, it said anusainti, they lie along with them. That is the second term here. They underlie these things. So if the views become, in a sense, habitually connected with these objects, they will arise repeatedly based on these objects. And then the third term, samudacharanti, translated here, they are exercised upon them. You could say that the views now they've become so habitually connected with these objects that they're almost inseparably attached to them. So the views have now become very fixed, obstinate, determinate in relation to these objects. But now, in order to break free from these views, to overcome them, to abandon them, what the antidote, the remedy that the Buddha prescribes, is to contemplate these objects, to see them with correct wisdom, the wisdom that understands things as they truly are, that is to see them as not mine, not I, not myself. Now these are very important terms, three very important terms. Okay, now these three terms that the Buddha uses, these three phrases, are three types of contemplation which are intended to counteract three basic, fundamental, say, defilements, or the word used is grips or obsessions of the mind. The three grips or obsessions are craving, conceit, and views. And so craving is that particular force by which we reach out and grasp onto things and claim things to be mine. Okay, so to counteract craving, the antidote, the remedy that the Buddha prescribes is to see that all of these things, netang mama, this is not mine. Okay, then the second grip or obsession is conceit. We are always thinking, I am this, I am better, I am just equal, I am worse. We're always comparing, measuring ourselves. This is because there's underlying this is the idea of I am, and we're identifying that I am with something within these five aggregates. Okay, so the remedy for this, the antidote, is to contemplate ne so hamasmi. I am not this. And when we contemplate I am not this, then the sense of I am loses its weight, loses its force, and we overcome the sense of I am with regard to the five aggregates. And then the third force, the third obsession or grip, is the grip of views. That's the concern right in this discussion. The views of self, views of world, particularly the views of self. And so to overcome the view of self, one contemplates that whatever one is taking to be self, whether it be body, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, consciousness, one contemplates this is not myself. And that is the antidote, the remedy to this obsession with the idea of self. That idea of self, that's the nucleus around which all of these views are woven. And when one gives up, overcomes, or penetrates this idea of self, then all of the views fall away. And so here the Buddha is concerned especially with the overcoming of views, but he brings in all three of these contemplations. And so when one contemplates that basis for the arising of views, views about the self, views about the world, when one contemplates that as this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself, then all of these views are overcome. That is because this contemplation of not mine, not I, not myself, when it's followed through to its consummation, eventually it leads to the realization of stream entry, sotapatti. And with the realization of stream entry, then all of the views are relinquished and abandoned. Okay, there's a basic idea now. This passage, this question and answer, is the opening of the sutta. And what seems to underlie this opening passage, again, I throw another Pali word, which doesn't occur in the sutta, but it's the word, I think it's the key word to the sutta. Buddhimana, which means, the meaning is, putting it in simple terms, it's ranking oneself too high or overestimating one's achievements, one's attainments. And this is a big problem that faces many meditators, many practitioners, because one can have special experiences, unusual experiences, and then think that these experiences mean that one has reached true attainment or true realization. So that idea of ranking oneself too high figures in this introductory discussion, because the question, Mahachandra's question, implies that some monks who are just beginning their practice of meditation, their insight meditation, probably thought that they would overcome all tendencies to views. They thought that they had abandoned and relinquished wrong views. And so the commentary says that Mahachandra himself was an arhat. He couldn't have had any wrong views. But he probably asked this question for the benefit of those who might have been overestimating themselves. And so he wants the Buddha to clarify that one doesn't overcome wrong views about the self, about the world, at the very beginning of one's training, just by starting the practice of insight. And in reply, the Buddha shows the proper method for abandoning and relinquishing all of these views. Okay, now the Buddha picks up on this idea of overrating oneself, ranking oneself too high, overestimating one's achievements, by going through the 8 meditative attainments in the sphere or domain of samadhi, of concentration. Now, usually in the suttas, the Buddha praises the attainment of the jhanas and even the attainment of the formless attainment. We saw last semester, last semester, when we read the Chulahati Padopama Sutta, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint, the Buddha speaks about the 4 jhanas. He says that they are footprints of the Tathagata, that the disciple reaches on the way to liberation. And then in the greater discourse at Asapura, the Buddha gives these beautiful similes to illustrate the splendor of the jhanas. But now the Buddha praises the jhanas because they are sublime states of concentration. They help to unify the mind, collect the mind, and make it a fit vehicle for the arising of wisdom. And also in themselves, they are very sublime, lofty, majestic states of consciousness. But what seems to be the case is that it's possible for those who are people who have a natural disposition for collecting the mind for concentration, to enter into the jhanas while they have not yet settled some of the weak spots and defects in their character, weak spots and defects which stem from the defilements. So it seems to me that the Buddha's purpose in this sutta is to show that even though one might be able to enter into the jhanas, enter into the formless attainments, the arupa samapattis, the attainments beyond the jhanas, there might still be tendencies, unwholesome tendencies in one's character, which one has a blind spot towards, one is not taking full account of. And so one might be able to just zoom the mind in to these states of concentrated attention and zoom up into these lofty spheres of bliss, tranquility, and yet these defilements will still be lingering in the mind, ready to, at some point, to trip one up and cause one to collapse and fall down, if one hasn't really done the work of recognizing them within oneself and make a determined effort to wear them away, to erode them through this process of salaka, of gradually eroding, gradually erasing, gradually, what was the word you gave me? Gradually reducing, eliminating these defilements. Okay, so the Buddha starts, he says, it is possible here, Chanda, that quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. He might think thus, I am abiding in effacement. That is, or I am abiding in the removal, the eradication of unwholesome tendencies. But the Buddha says it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called pleasant abiding in the Noble One's discipline. Pleasant abidings, that is, because the jhana, the absorption, it's a very pleasant, very happy state that one enters and one experiences it right here and now in this very life. It's a very blissful state to be experienced right here and now. Okay, so the Buddha says, these are called pleasant abidings here and now in the Noble One's discipline. Okay, now what the commentary says, and it gives a very useful explanation, it says that in the Buddha's discipline, that's the Noble One's discipline, the jhana is to be used as a basis for developing insight or wisdom. And so when the Buddha teaches the attainment of jhanas, he doesn't teach them as ends in themselves, but he teaches the jhanas as means for, first, for drawing the mind away from its entanglement in the pleasures of the senses. Because what gives the mind always has to have some pleasure or happiness. So first one pulls it away with some higher pleasure, higher happiness, the pleasure of the sublime, blissful, inner happiness. And then, having drawn the mind away from that lower pleasure towards the higher pleasure, one doesn't remain there, but one uses that one-pointed or concentrated mind as a means for investigating and examining the nature of the dhammas, the phenomena, or the sankharas, conditioned phenomena, in order to tune in on them and to see their impermanence, their instability, their selfless and insubstantial nature. But here, in this passage, the Buddha is taking the case of a monk who just enters into the jhana and then gets carried away by this rapture and pleasure and becomes attached to it and thinks that he's eliminating defilements just by dwelling in that state, but doesn't come out and use it as a means for investigation, for examination. Okay, the same thing is repeated for the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. They're all called pleasant abidings here and now in the Noble One's discipline. And since I've explained the jhanas previously in other suttas, I won't go through and explain them again. But now, in paragraph number 8, we come to the base of the infinity of space. This is the first of the four formless attainments. Okay, now the four jhanas take as their object some form. Their object is something called rupa or form. For example, in attaining the jhanas, one might use something called the kasina. Kasina would be like a colored disc, a disc representing one of the elements. And one focuses the mind on this kasina until one gets this mental interior image of the kasina. And the mind becomes completely absorbed into that inner image, that sign or form of the kasina object. It could be a colored circle, a bright, radiant light. And one uses that object, or one uses that form, that bright light, that image, as the object for the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Okay, in the fourth jhana now, one wants to go beyond the jhanas to the formless attainment. So one will take now this form, that's the object of the fourth jhana. It might be a colored circle or a bright light, a circle of light. And one now, through mental determination, one expands this light, this form, till it becomes boundless. So it's covering the entire inner space, mental image of inner, or the mental sphere of inner space. And the mind is now completely absorbed upon that boundless or immeasurable, measureless, unbounded, visualized form. And now to enter the base of the infinity of space, what one does is make the determination, the resolution, let this form vanish. Let the form disappear. And when the mind has become sufficiently conditioned, then the form vanishes, disappears. And what remains as the object of the attention, the object of awareness, is the boundless space that that form was covering, that bright, measureless light, bright, measureless, colored expanse was covering. And so now the mind is completely immersed in this boundless space, this measureless expanse of space. And this is described as the complete surmounting, in paragraph 8, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite. Some bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite space. Again, he might think, I am abiding in effacement. But it is not these attainments that are called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called, notice the difference here, these are not called pleasant abiding here and now, not sukha vihara, but now these are called peaceful abiding. These are called santa vihara, peaceful abidings in the Noble One's discipline. This is because in the jhanas, actually really in the first three jhanas, that is present pleasant feeling or a happy feeling. In the fourth jhana, even in the fourth jhana, the pleasant feeling is gone. There's equanimity. The feeling is neither pleasant nor painful. But still, just as a mode of expression, the fourth jhana is also called a pleasant abiding here and now. But it's really, the fourth jhana is really a peaceful abiding. But you have to call all the jhanas together pleasant abidings here and now. But when one goes beyond the fourth jhana to the formless attainment, then it's extremely peaceful, because the mind is just now, it's as though the mind is just merged into infinite space. So there's no, like, space itself is completely undisturbed. If you've ever traveled through space, to the moon, to Mars, or if you've ever gone through all these Hayden Planetarium on these imaginary trips to space, through space, throughout the planets. When you're traveling in the rocket ship, or you see these movies, they have these movies now where it's total immersion type movies. Don't they have them? Don't they? I'm afraid I've been in Sri Lanka too long. But I saw a couple of these, I think it was in Singapore in 2001. Yeah, so it seems like you go in and the screen is all around, and they, somehow they get this effect, like three-dimensional effect, so it seems like you're traveling through space. So everything is very peaceful out there. No wars, no famines, no droughts, no presidential elections. Okay, so one is now in the base of the infinity of space, but that's not effacement. Okay, now to go further, state beyond that. Okay, after one becomes accustomed and familiar with the base of the infinity of space, one can reflect back and see that what is aware of the infinity of space is the mind or consciousness. So it's actually as if the mind or consciousness is pervading this infinite space. So, through a simple shift in attention, instead of attending to the infinity of space, one shifts the focus to the consciousness or mind which is pervading that infinite space. And then, at a certain point, the object of awareness will become not the infinite space, but the consciousness or mind which has been pervading that infinite space. And then this is the entry upon the base of the infinity of consciousness. And so one who attains this might think, I am abiding in effacement. But again, the Buddha says, these are just called peaceful abidings in the Noble One's discipline. Okay, then, after one masters the base of the infinity of consciousness, one can start investigating. This is not the investigation with wisdom, but one looks into this base of infinite consciousness, and one sees that there's nothing solid there, nothing obstructive, nothing giving any impediment, that consciousness is just all pervasive without impediment. And so one focuses upon this unimpeded nature of the infinite consciousness, the aspect of there being nothing solid, nothing substantial there. But this is not a contemplation with wisdom. It's not the realization of shunyata, not the realization of non-self. It's just attending to a purely phenomenal aspect of it, that there's nothing obstructive or impeding in that consciousness. So one is focusing upon that aspect, that there's nothing obstructive there, nothing of an impeding nature. And when the mind latches upon that unobstructed, unimpeded nature of the base of infinite consciousness, that is the knowledge or the awareness of the base of nothingness. And so one now enters and abides in this attainment. But again, this is just a peaceful abiding, not dwelling in effacement. Okay, now this abiding in nothingness, this attainment of the sphere of nothingness, this is an extremely subtle state. It's the third formless attainment. Now, to go to the fourth stage, one turns the attention upon the consciousness, which is aware of the base of nothingness. And that consciousness, one tries to focus upon that perception that is aware of the base of nothingness. And that perception is extremely subtle. And when one focuses upon that very subtle perception, then one enters into the fourth formless attainment, which it is said has the consciousness of the base of nothingness as its object. And this fourth formless attainment is so subtle that one cannot say that perception is present within it. And yet one cannot say that there is no perception within it. It says that the perception is still present, but it's so subtle that it's not performing the normal function of perception. It's just so subtle that if one tries to detect it, one can perceive it. But if one doesn't try to perceive it, one will be vaguely aware that there is some perception functioning, but at such very, very subtle level that one can't even describe it fully and distinctly as perception. I think of this by analogy with, there was a tree outside the hermitage where I lived in Kandy. We call it the Na tree in singular. In Pali, it's called the Naga tree. This is supposed to be the tree, type of tree under which Maitreya Buddha will become enlightened. It has a very, very beautiful scent, I think, of any tree that I've ever, whose scent I've ever smelled, the most beautiful scent. But the scent, it's so subtle, or at least of this particular tree, when I would come out in the morning, I would smell it and think, wow, what a beautiful scent. But then when I think, I want to smell it more, and then it sniff, it's so subtle that then one can smell it. It sort of has to, you could only smell the beautiful scent when it hits you without any deliberate effort on your part. And so here the perception is so subtle that the function of perception only takes place when there's no deliberate effort to perceive, or so it is said. Okay, so now this monk might think, who attains this, might think, I am abiding in effacement. But the Buddha says, these attainments are not called effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called peaceful abiding in the Noble One's discipline. Okay, at this point, I will stop and then ask if there is any question. So, yeah, but before that, one could use the mindfulness of breathing as a means for attaining the jhana. But before the first jhana is reached on the basis of mindfulness of breathing, the breath will give rise to a subtle nimitta or sign, which will be again like a colored circle, a star, a ball of light, and then that becomes the object of attention for gaining the jhana based on the in and out breathing. So initially the attention is focused on the breathing, but in order to go into the jhana based on the breathing, the attention has to be turned to the nimitta that arises based upon the breath. Yeah. The kasina, one begins with a physical object, like they have them colored circles, or for the earth kasina, it will be a disc that's prepared with earth. It's a kind of brace is used, formed into a circle, and then it rises up from a board, is placed on a board, like a strip of metal made into a circle, and then it's joined at the top so it holds together. Then that circle is filled with clay or earth, and then that's used as the initial meditation object. And so the meditator will place it a certain distance from himself. Prescribed distance, it shouldn't be too far so that one has to strain to see it. It shouldn't be too close so that it creates an impediment when one's trying to look at it. But a comfortable distance so that one looks at it with the eyes open part-time, then once one gets the image of the earth, then one closes and just goes on focusing earth, earth, earth. Then one will open the eyes again to get refresh the image of earth, earth, and close again and focus on the mental image. One keeps on doing this until one is able to get the mental image of earth, to see the earth with one's mind's eye just as clearly as one could see it with one's open eye. When that happens, then one no longer focuses upon that physical object, but just goes on focusing upon the mental object. if the mental object fades and becomes unclear, then one returns to the physical earth or kasina. No, there's still the object. There's no directing of the thought. Yes. Any further questions? Yes. Vipassana. Certain practices within the four foundations of mindfulness can be used as jhanic practices. Of course, mindfulness of breathing is there. One has mindfulness of breathing is one section of, and even the meditation on what's called the unattractive nature of the body, the asubha, the parts of the body, that can be used as a basis for gaining up to the first jhana only, but not for going beyond the first jhana. Excuse me? The Brahma Viharas can be used for gaining the jhanas, but they're not included. He asked about what is included within the Satipatthana system, and the Brahma Viharas aren't in the Satipatthana system. But certain of those exercises within the foundations of mindfulness can be used, for gaining the jhanas. But you take the Satipatthana system as a whole, and it's directed towards the development, the arising of insight. One can go about it that way, or else one can begin using the Satipatthana system itself without beginning with the jhanas. One could, in my view, one could take just the Satipatthana system and go directly through that without gaining the jhanas. As a direct, a route of direct vipassana, direct insight, without gaining jhanic attainment. In my view, understanding, one could take the route of dry insight without jhana up to the second attainment, the second stage, one's returning. But I leave open the possibility one perhaps the Satipatthana method or the Satipatthana system is a method that will lead all the ways to arhatship without depending upon jhana. It seems to me the suttas are somewhat open-ended so that one can't just tie them down and say this is the fixed rule, it has to be this way. Some suttas seem to be almost to be saying it has to be this way, but then there are other suttas which seem to be saying, well, maybe it's not strictly only that way, but maybe you could take this route as well. So there are many people that grasp upon one sutta or a limited number of suttas and say, it has to be this way. Others grasp this sutta and say, well, it's that way. But if you take a sort of panoramic view of them from above, one could see many different ways. Certain ways seem to be definitely ruled out. Any more questions? Okay, anyway, this is what took all this first class. This is the part of the sutta that I was hoping to get through rather quickly because it's rather remote from our usual experience. It's the part that comes from that we'll start on next week, which is the more interesting, more important, more practical part. That's the part that's concerned with effacement or the gradual erosion, reduction of defilement. Okay, so we will continue next week. We share the merit. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mantaram etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu.